This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist at Murphy and Silvest. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks to you. I appreciate being here.
I chuckled at the opening of your newsletter. The man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. I don't know if Chairman Powell is going to appreciate your characterization of him.
Well, considering he's more of a Deadhead fan, I'm not sure he's actually a Beatles fan either. But really, when you look at some of his comments over the last 2 to 3 weeks, he has not changed his comments about the markets or comments about interest rates, comments about inflation, or the economy. He has said the exact same thing Friday when the market was closed on Good Friday as he did yesterday, yet the markets are interpreting it very differently today than they did on Monday when the markets opened up. So I give him credit for being very consistent, but the markets, I think, are trying to read a lot into it and maybe hoping that the Fed cuts rates sooner than later.
Yeah. Talk to me about the difference between last week and this week, and what's your interpretation of that? Why are the markets reading whatever they're reading?
I think, you know, some of it is, I think some of it is hope, but some of it too is, you know, they're listening to the comments about, we think inflation is going to make our target. And I think that's where a lot of the weight is going with the market and investors now, is saying he thinks we're going to get down to the 2% inflation rate sometime this year, and that's going to allow a Fed to cut interest rates. I'm not so sure that that's going to happen, but I think that's where a lot of the market participants are looking at the commentary and saying, well, if he believes that's going to be the case, then I'm going to invest accordingly.
Well, if we go from 3% to 2% and then they decide to lower interest rates, that will be maybe not shocking, but also, I guess, pretty good news. I'm half interested in the politics of that. That is, if people don't believe the economy is doing well, or their personal economies aren't doing well because it's still pretty expensive to live, if we go from 3-something to 2-something, I don't know that that's going to represent a dramatic change in people's personal finances. And then I wonder what that means for Joe Biden. We don't need to go too far down that road. But you know what I mean? I wonder what the significance will be to the average American, since we're really adding in the previous few years of increased inflation. What's the difference between 3 and 2 now when we're already up 20% over the last 4 years?
No, you're absolutely right. And then I think it's part of the reason why a lot of investors, a lot of consumers are feeling the pain and don't feel all that wonderful about how the economy is doing. And we can look at the numbers. There was an interesting article in the Journal yesterday, day before yesterday, was saying, you know, the people aren't believing the numbers. Well, they're not believing the numbers because they're living their life and seeing for themselves what's really happening. We're seeing it at the gas pump. You're seeing it at the grocery store. We're going to see it in the egg prices now with avian bird flu. That's going to work its way through the egg ecosystem.
Right.
All of those types of things, though, contribute to, and many will take it, oh, it's a one-off. Well, you get enough of those one-offs, and it starts to add up to something important.
Sure. But is that something that a Republican or Democrat president or Congress can do anything about? We don't control the international price of petroleum or oil. There's nothing we can do about bird flu or the price of eggs, really. You know, some of these things are out of any president's control, are they not?
No, that's true. What is in their control and what some of the issues can be pointed back to is very easy monetary policy and some of the fiscal largesse that has occurred over the last, you know, even a decade. You know, you take a look at the amount of debt that we have today, and with higher interest rates, that debt payment now is roughly equal to now the defense budget. So what we're spending on just paying for our debt is getting to be a bigger and bigger piece of the overall pie. And until Congress decides that they want to do something about it, we're going to be in this situation for a while. And, you know, again, going back to the politics of it, those that are out of office are the fiscally responsible ones, and those that are in office are the, you know, the spendthrift, you know, the spending like crazy. And it doesn't matter which party is which, but that's kind of the roles that they take.
Well, both presidents approved a lot of that massive cash outlay to people. It started with Donald Trump during the pandemic, but Joe Biden had his finger in that too.
Sure. And it's still in the economy. You know, you take a look at a lot of ways to look at money in the system, in the banking system, in the financial world. It's still there. And the Fed has started to pull some of that back. But generally, monetary policy and stresses in the economy are very, very low at this point. So, again, it's stuff that's still working its way through the economy and likely to be there for quite some time until we're able to pull back those dollars back to the U.S. government.
Good to hear your voice. Good to get your thoughts. Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor, Market Analyst, Murphy and Silvest. Thank you, Paul.
We'll talk soon. Thanks.
It's always a pleasure to visit with Bree Fowler, the Senior Writer at CNET. Welcome back, Bree.
Thanks for having me.
I saw a story locally because I was in one of these Amazon stores where you just pick the item up and you don't have to go to a cash register, and somehow Amazon would know what the food item was you put in your cart. They're rolling that back, huh?
Yeah, just in the Amazon Fresh grocery stores where, you know, you probably have a whole cart full of items. They're still going to have it at those Amazon Go stores where, you know, you're just grabbing a couple things and heading out the door. But basically, they got customer feedback that people were experiencing some sticker shock once they, you know, checked out and they realized they had so much stuff in their cart.
Oh, wait a minute. So people, oh, this is convenient. I'll get that. And then I just walk out. It'll automatically charge my credit card. Hokey smokes. Look at how much I just spent.
Exactly. I mean, I think we've all kind of had those moments at the grocery store, especially with inflation and things costing more than they used to. You know, you think, well, how did I spend $100? I only have 2 bags of groceries, and it's just kind of nuts these days.
So it wasn't so much that the technology wasn't working or people were stealing from them. It was almost too easy for people to shop.
Yeah, and this, what they're replacing it with are smart carts that, you know, supposedly will show you when you put something in your cart, it gives you a running tally of how much you're spending. So, you know, oh, wow, that was more expensive than I thought, or I've already hit that, you know, $100 threshold or however much I want to spend. You can put stuff back or, you know, make a decision, and then you're avoiding maybe that sticker shock. It just gives people more visibility. But, you know, again, they'll still have it at those Amazon Go, like, convenience stores where you're probably just grabbing maybe chips and a soda or something like that.
Those smart carts sure sound like a good idea. I've never been in one of those, used one of those, but that sounds, boy, everybody should have that.
Yeah, it definitely would be handy, you know, just to have that kind of visual calculator to see what's in your cart. And, you know, I feel like every time I go to the grocery store, there's some items that aren't labeled or they're on the wrong shelf, or and you really don't know how much it's going to cost till you get to checkout, and then you're kind of stuck with it. So the visibility is always good for the consumer.
The Whole Foods I go to probably doesn't want you to know. They will block out certain items. I saw a story, too, about George Carlin and his estate. There was a concert or an album, a video that came out of George Carlin comedy where they used AI to generate material a la him. What's the status of that?
Yeah, so these guys basically, they have a podcast, and they created a one-hour comedy special, a fake one, that was supposedly used AI to recreate what he would have said or what would have been new material. And, you know, part of me is really curious to see what this was and how good it was and how funny. But the estate sued. His daughter was very upset because, you know, you're using someone's intellectual property and it's someone who's not really there anymore to speak up either. And they got them to take it down. And, you know, this may set a precedent down the road for just the use of people's likenesses, their personalities, things like that, especially after they're gone.
But this was not, was this a court order or was this just an agreement?
This, It's a settlement. It's a proposed order that, like a settlement that was filed with a federal court, and it has to be approved by a judge. But this is something that the two parties have settled on, and it avoids paying money.
Well, fair enough. I can appreciate that, but I also wonder then, to what degree is this a precedent? Because it doesn't sound like it was a court decision, but rather the court supervised an agreement between two parties. The point is that in that special that they created using AI, they took sampled George Carlin's voice, but the computer wrote the material, right? Or somebody else did. So it wasn't George Carlin material, and it wasn't George Carlin's voice per se. It was a computer that I guess all originally sprung from George Carlin's voice. I guess my point is, I'm wondering to what degree does the Carlin estate, does the daughter Kelly actually have a case? Because you see what I'm saying?
I mean, it's one of those things that the courts are going to have to figure out, because it's not just comedy. It's, you know, authors have sued, you know, newspapers have sued because the AI is being trained with all the copyrighted material. Like, it wouldn't be able to do this without that material. And you're feeding it and feeding it and feeding it, and then it's generating results that are based on copyrighted material, or, you know, someone's thoughts or work that previously existed. So it's definitely something we're going to have to sort out soon.
Well, that does make a case for then the Carlson people, while the computer wrote the material, it sampled previous material. So therein lies the theft, if you will.
And some, you know, ChatGPT has licensed some of the Associated Press, you know, other content, news content, things like that, to avoid these kinds of disputes.
But didn't the New York Times, what was the New York Times involvement in this? Didn't they push back on sampling their material for artificial intelligence?
I'm fairly sure that they sued over it. I'm not sure what the status of that is right now. You know, all kinds of litigation takes forever to play out. So, I guess we're going to have to see.
Give me the headline on Tesla. What's the latest on sales there?
So their sales, they fizzled a bit in the last quarter. Vehicle sales growth has slowed. Price cuts just aren't drawing in more buyers. They came in way below analyst expectations. And, you know, some analysts are kind of worried about how this will carry over to the rest of electronic vehicles in those companies.
386,000 vehicles worldwide, 9% below the 423,000 it sold in the same quarter last year. Okay, something to keep our eye on. And we'll let you do that. Bree, thank you for your help today.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Bree Fowler is a senior writer at CNET. Somnium means to dream in Latin. Maybe you didn't know that. Steve Ellingson does. He is a veteran of the hospitality industry. Steve joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch as the founder and president of Somnium Hospitality Group. Steven, you're on WGN. Welcome to the show.
John, thank you so much for having us with you today.
So you don't manage a single hotel per se, but provide consulting to the industry. Is that it?
Well, we're a management and asset management company. So we currently have a portfolio of 7 hotels across the United States that we manage and asset manage, branded and unbranded. And so our experience is in that area. We also offer consultancy and support to hotels, food and beverage operations, golf courses, and we have a pretty big depth of understanding within the industry that we offer.
What do you mean by asset manage?
So asset manage means an owner owns an asset, it is a brand or an unbranded hotel. It has a management company in place, but the owner needs a support structure or an advisor, so to say, to come in and help them navigate, you know, really ensuring the value and performance of that asset. So we step in and partner both with the brand in some cases and with the management company to really support our ownership group. In many cases, we have several assets with an ownership group from California called KCB Real Estate. So it's a real estate company, so they don't come from a hotel background. And so my role within Somnium in supporting these assets is to really help them navigate maximizing performance and value.
How long you been doing this, Steve?
I started in the hotel business frighteningly, 31 years ago as a front desk agent at the Ritz-Carlton in Laguna Niguel, and didn't at that time even really think it was going to be a long-term career. I just I needed an opportunity, and it was a beautiful place to work, and I thought it was something different and just fell in love with the business.
So you started this company, though, this year, right?
Yes, we started to evolve things at the end of last year. Again, working with a couple of the properties specifically, and then had our opportunity to get our Hilton approval and several other major brand approvals, which is part of the process of really launching your own management company. And so now we're fully engaged and completely operational as of the beginning of this year. Yes.
So give me an example of a property that you are working with and what you do for them specifically.
Well, our overall approach is within owners is to provide, honestly, a comprehensive operational stabilization. You know, many of these properties are still recovering or still trying to get through things, so we strategically help them navigate that. Our process really initially, and it's pretty straightforward, is to take each property and outline and define a clear strategy based on what that individual property needs or that asset needs, whether it's revenue generation, whether it's NOI, whether it's stabilizing it for a possible refinance coming up. Then our role and our chief operating officer's role, Dan White, is really to communicate and implement that strategy, which can be a myriad of things. It can be operational, it could be controls, it could be revenue generation, really get in there and do that. And then our special sauce, I should say, is between the two of us, we have over 50 years of experience. So we really measure and monitor that performance. And within that, you know, you have to pivot and change. And we've been able to do that through the pandemic and in the Chicago markets and other. And then finally, really part of this is we don't call our team members, we call them dream members because they're part of our dream. So a big part of our evolution, what we try to do is we really want to recognize and honor the success and achievement when we have those. So those are really our four pillars of how we launch and what we offer to owners.
Well, how's the industry doing these days? It seems to me like people are traveling again, probably less business travel than before the pandemic, but it seems to me like the hotel business isn't as strained as it was 2 years ago, right?
We are in recovery, depending on the market. We asset manage an asset in Portland, which is still very much a struggling market. You know, first, as I said, our role and what we're trying to do is owners really have to find a good partner, you know, to help them support and navigate this recovery. A big thing we're seeing and continue to see is really big revenue volatility by market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, occupancy and ADRs are just unstable. Strategic pricing really has to be deployed. And, you know, you got to be on top of it all the time. You have to. Revenue management is just such a key piece of our business now, and having a strategy where you're focused on that. And big challenge for owners and operators is labor. You know, the pandemic changed the labor market and staffing, and our industry, you know, we have severe labor challenges, as you know, and that's only made worse by costs overall have increased. And depending on the owner you're dealing with, they have debt and financial issues. So, you know, the responsibility of Somnium or partners is dealing with that debt for underperforming assets, you know, guiding them through that process so they can, you know, stabilize and find value within those assets or really make the proper decisions to be servicing debt, you know, and those are big challenges that are still faced to many owners in many markets.
Well, the market for office space is very competitive in a lot of cities because they're trying to attract people back. We know this in Chicago. And so the businesses or the buildings that are going to succeed are those that are upping their game. It's not just a fresh coat of paint. It's new services and amenities, and it gets very competitive. I wonder if it's that way in the hotel business. Is it your place had better look good? That pool had better be clean. The menu in the restaurant and bar had better be good. Are those the sorts of things we're talking about?
Yes, it's not enough to just focus on guest service anymore. You've got to create different experiences. You've got to create new revenue streams. You have to think outside of the box for your owners. We've looked at food and beverage opportunities that are different. We've looked at, we have a major resort, Oak Brook Hills Resort and Conference Center on the west side of Chicago. You may be familiar.
We've
done some dynamic.
I know that place.
Yeah. So we manage and asset manage that hotel for our ownership group. And so within that, we've had to come up with some different ideas of how we can find new partners and find new revenue streams and create new ideas. So it's not just having good service, as you say, and a beautiful product. You have to continue to evolve and continue to find new ways to not only increase the top line, but the bottom line.
I wonder how you do that. Is it a golf package at the golf course nearby? Is it a shuttle bus to the shopping center nearby? I don't know what else you can do other than drinks and food and then parking. I don't know. Are you going to charge for towels at the pool? I mean, how do you generate more revenue at a place like that?
Well, we're currently working with a food and beverage operation that's a sushi suite that provides a dynamic and unique experience within the hotel, different from what you currently have. We're evolving that. We haven't launched it yet, but we're speaking with them. And my partner, Dan White, he successfully executed this in another property. So it's within that, it's giving that guest a different type of experience, mm-hmm. a unique experience where it's individual. They feel special. They feel part of something that's not in a, so to say, it is a public space in the sense that it's a suite that's been converted into a food and beverage operation, but it creates a level of exclusivity that I think people are willing to pay for, they're interested in. So just things like that just don't normally fall under the operational, okay, well, let's open a restaurant, let's get three menus, let's get things together. Like, how do you create something that has a story to tell? Because that also can be compelling, even just not with individually with the performance of that extension of your property, but you want stories to tell. You want things that you can get out there on reels and things that you can share, which create interest in your organization, your property.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds challenging, but also really interesting and exciting. Steve Ellingson is the founder and president of Somnium Hospitality Group. That's SOMNIUM, SomniumHospitalityGroup.com. Stephen, continued success. Keep us posted on what you're doing. It sounds very interesting.
John, what a pleasure being with you today. Thank you for having us on.
More business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Workers at another Starbucks in Chicago have voted to unionize. Employees at 58th and Western voted unanimously to join Starbucks Workers United. It's the 23rd location in Illinois to unionize. Organizers say 420 Starbucks nationwide in 43 states have successfully unionized, more than any other company in the 21st century. Workers say they want better pay, benefits, and working conditions. The national organizing effort at Starbucks includes nearly 10,000 workers. A new analysis says the Chicago area is one of the top areas in the country to see a decline in employment. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows the Naperville, Chicago, Elgin area lost more than 81,000 jobs over the last 4 years. Chicago joins Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco with the biggest decreases in the number of people employed. Dallas, Phoenix, Austin, Houston, and Tampa lead the country with employment gains. Employment is up 1.6 million in the top 10 metro areas where job growth has been the strongest. 1.1 million fewer people were working in the 21 metro areas with the lower employment. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Business of Food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And do you know somebody who has the itch to plant?
I do.
Sorry, still too early, as evidenced by today's weather, but there are a lot of us who have the itch to get out there and start planting, be it the garden or in the field. And Illinois farmers have shared how many acres of corn and soybeans they plan on planting this year. The numbers, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today, there has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. If you know a corn or soybean farmer, they will likely tell you business is in the pits right now. 2 years ago, corn was selling for more than $8 a bushel. For most of the past year, the price has been almost half that. Similar situation for soybeans, but both markets got a tiny boost last week when the USDA's planting intentions report came in. That's where farmers are surveyed and tell how many acres they're going to plant. Let's begin with the corn numbers from Mark Schleusner, the USDA's stats man in Springfield.
For corn in Illinois, NAS expects the 2024 corn planted area to be 10.9 million acres, down 300,000 from last year.
Soybeans.
Soybean planted area in Illinois is expected to be 10.5 million acres, up 1% from 2023.
But farmers were surveyed weeks ago, and in most cases we're still weeks away from planters rolling in this part of the state.
And so there is opportunity for farmers to change their mind.
That is Lance Honig with the USDA.
The economic situation could change. The weather may not cooperate with what some of those plans are.
Another surprise in a USDA report last week was just how much of last last year's crop is still being stored on farms where farmers have been waiting for prices to go up before they sell. They're holding on to about 20% more than at this time last year. Joe Jansen is an ag economist at the University of Illinois.
The cost of holding on to that grain is piling up. The farmer has a significant marketing challenge ahead of him in what looks like to be, you know, pretty challenging marketing conditions.
Yeah, that's why farmers don't need to go to casinos. They can gamble right there on the farm. Good luck to all of those men and women who put food on our table. And thank you. From the farm to your belly, today's National Chicken Cordon Bleu Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
On WGN Radio, so everybody keeps checking the weather for Monday at 2:07 in Chicago. What's it going to be like? Producer Pete handed me this. It says the best chances for clear viewing across the U.S. of A., most likely in northern New England and upstate New York. Those have clear skies and the path of totality. But they say that they are more and more likely to see clear enough skies in southern Missouri into central Indiana. So right through Indianapolis, which is really the nearest spot to us anyway for totality, it'll be 94% occlusion in Chicago, 94% occlusion in Chicago. But guess what? You can go up to the top of the Hancock Building and look at the eclipse from the 360 Chicago viewing deck. Let's have a visit with Nicole Benolkin, the managing director at 360 Chicago. Hi, Nicole. You're on WGN. How are you?
Thank you so much for having us, and it's great to talk with you again.
So tell us a little bit about your place, first of all.
Of course. So 360 Chicago is the observation deck at the top of 875 North Michigan Avenue, which, yes, used to be and is affectionately still known as the Hancock.
Right.
So we're about 17,000 square feet of space up here. We've got Cloud Bar. We've got Tilt, which is our thrill feature. And we really have the very best place to watch the solar eclipse come Monday.
Yeah, right. Although one wonders, I mean, the eclipse is there for everybody. So what do you have that just standing on the ground doesn't have?
Well, I think because you're going to want to try to get the best view of the sun and not have to deal with buildings or, you know, other elements of the Chicago skyline and landscape get in your way, getting above the tops of the roofs and getting a really unobstructed view of the sky makes our location ideal for viewing the eclipse on Monday.
Yeah, that does make sense. I mean, it'd be a shame if where you happen to be standing was maybe not the best viewing area, and a lot of people will be in the city. And it's just a nice place to be, period. I mean, you guys are there all year long anyway, right?
We are. We're open 363 days out of the year, with the exception of Thanksgiving and Christmas, from 9 a.m. till 11 p.m. And yeah, you know, John, I think people say that the best way to view it is to try to find an open field. And that's certainly true, but I think there's not many of those in downtown Chicago. So we'd encourage anyone that's down here and wants to get a great view of the eclipse on Monday to come by and visit us.
So you're on the 94th floor, but there's still a roof, right?
There is, yeah. So we're not the very top of the building. The top of the building is broadcast and mechanical. But we do have 360-degree windows, so you have the ability to move freely around as you're trying to keep track of that eclipse traverse through the sky.
So will you hand out glasses for people, too, then?
Absolutely. And we learned our lesson in 2017. We did not have enough glasses for the number of people that showed up the last time we had a partial eclipse here in Chicago. So we are prepared. We're going to have glasses for every guest that comes to visit. And those are included in the cost of the ticket, so no additional cost there. And we're also going to have Dr. Joseph Warner from Visionary Eye Care on the floor to talk about eye safety and give some tips for safe viewing during the eclipse.
Okay, great. So what do I do to get my ticket now? Just go to 360chicago.com?
Yeah, we'd recommend booking in advance. Reservations or time tickets are required. And you can go to 360chicago.com/tickets, and you can get your tickets right there. And, you know, we also will have Cloud Bar open during the eclipse. So it's also a great place to get a cocktail or a glass of wine or one of our local beers and have those in hand while you're watching this 94% occlusion on Monday.
Yeah, what a memorable way to spend some time in the city and a memorable event as well. Nicole Benolkin is the Managing Director, 360 Chicago. Check it out at 360chicago.com. Thank you, Nicole.
John, thank you so much. Have a great day.